3330 Minnesota, Douglas Kelly versus Safe Harbor Managed Account 101.
All right. Good morning, Mr. Levin. We'll hear from you first.
Good morning, Your Honor. Thank you very much. Neil Levin for Douglas Kelly in his capacity as the...
Excuse me. I was advised Levin, but it's Levin, so...
It is Levin. That's fine, Your Honor. It happens quite frequently. I'm used to it. Thank you. Again, Neil Levin for Douglas Kelly in his capacity as the trustee of the PCI Liquidating Trust. Your Honor, yesterday evening I was having dinner with my wife and 17-year-old daughter who has a rudimentary understanding of Ponzi schemes because of the work that we do. And she asked, what is this case about? And so I was compelled to bring it to something just above layman's terms in explaining to them what we would be arguing today. And what I quickly realized was how we have rather grossly overcomplicated the issue here. This is a relatively simple matter. It's a contentious matter. I will allow for that. The concept of the 546E protection provision of the bankruptcy code is one that a lot of people are talking about, and I think we'll continue to do so for quite some time. But let me very briefly walk through what I see, though, as the issues as they pertain specifically to this case. I know that we're not going to rewrite 546E here. I know we're not going to have a huge discussion on legislative intent and its various history, but I do think that we can get to the relevant portions and see why there were errors made at the district court level. The list of errors include believing that the Supreme Court denied certiorari in Tribune at the time of the hearing. The district court erred also in incorrectly identifying the parties to the note purchase agreement. The district court also erred in failing to look at the substance behind the labels given to the various entities and the documents. And the district court erred by not analyzing the proper definition of custodian to determine whether Wells Fargo was in fact a custodian or a financial institution for purposes of applying 546E. More specifically, for Section 546E to apply, I'm sure the court has seen this before, the court had to find that ACP2 is a financial institution for purposes of the application of that statute, and that the transfers were made, quote, in connection with a securities contract. Those are the two provisions we're dealing with here. In determining that the transfers were made to a financial institution, the court assumed, without analysis, that Wells Fargo was a custodian, did so with respect to transfers different from the transfers that the trustee is actually seeking to avoid, and failed to apply the binding Supreme Court authority in merit management. There is no other Supreme Court...
Counsel, you've identified several errors, and some of them seem to be almost factual in terms of, as I understand it, the parties agree that the district court was talking about a transfer that is not the one that's being sought to be avoided. So if that is conceded, and I can certainly ask counsel for the other side as well, but what do we do? Are you asking then this court to do the initial analysis in terms of what that transfer is and then who's a custodian vis-a-vis a transfer of funds?
That's a great question, and no, I don't think that that would be proper for this court to do. I think this court only needs to recognize that those errors were in fact made and send it back. I think that when we do the analysis, and we've included, and forgive me, I apologize, that's where I think we overcomplicated this. We got deep into the analysis that we think should have happened that didn't happen. And we're highlighting how it is that those provisions were misapplied here. But to your point, and I think it's a great one, we need to send this back. The district court erred.
If it's just a matter of the court having used the wrong party, but the transaction is still the same, couldn't we just do the analysis and decide whether ACP is a financial institution and whether this transaction was in connection with securities? And if the judge was right on those two things, then affirm.
But I don't believe the judge was right on those things.
I know you don't, but I'm saying... I don't know why we'd have to remand if those are just legal issues.
I believe that that is accurate, Your Honor. I do believe that you would have the jurisdiction to go ahead and resolve those based on the facts that were presented, though I do think that there are some holes in the facts as well, and that's where the remand would be necessary. For instance, we didn't get into the definition. We didn't get into the substance of the note purchase agreement versus the credit agreement. We didn't get into the substance of whether or not Wells Fargo is actually a custodian. So there are labels that have been used here, as we highlight in our briefs, that have not been pared down to understand what's beneath those labels. And some of the cases we've cited say you can't just look at the labels. You've got to pare it down. And those errors, I think, are not ones that you could remedy. Those errors, I think, are ones that the district court would have to do.
Is the credit agreement in the record?
So it is, Your Honor, and if I could direct the court's attention to page 7 of our brief, this small little diagram, the appellant's brief, this small little diagram really sums it all up for us quite neatly. And I don't think there's any dispute as to fact, as to this structure as vis-a-vis the parties. But this all got mishmashed together at the district court level, and even in the appellee's opening, or in their brief, in their opening statement, they mishmashed this together. There are two sets of parties and two types of transactions or transfers. And let me walk you through it very briefly. PCI owns MGC Finance. Those are the debtors. Those are the debtors' entities. MGC Finance worked out a deal with Metro One, or ACP2, to get loans to use in Petter's fraudulent scheme. Those loans were evidenced by loan documents, typical bank loan documents, and there was a credit agreement which would override or be umbrella over all the various loans. Not unusual when you have multiple loans to a borrower that you would have a credit agreement which sort of governs all the loans that would then be considered under the lending arrangement. Those loans resulted in money being paid by ACP2 to MGC Finance, the debtor. That was all under loan agreement. What ACP2 decided to do at that point was pull up their loans and sell them off. And that then became the note purchase agreement. That note purchase agreement had nothing to do with the debtor. Nothing. The debtor was not a party to that subsequent agreement. So after the money was being loaned pursuant to loan agreements and the credit agreement, it was Mr. Fry, who headed up ACP2, who decided, well, I'm going to now package those loans up and put them in a note purchase agreement and get people to invest in that. And that's where Safe Harbor invested. Safe Harbor did not loan money to the debtor. Safe Harbor did not pay money to the debtor. And Safe Harbor did not get money directly from the debtor. Safe Harbor transaction was with ACP2, a transferee of the debtor. So let me clarify this one step further. The trustee seeks to avoid the transfer against the initial transferee, but then seeks to recover money under 550 against subsequent transferees. Yes, the subsequent transferee gets the benefit of the 546E protection, but not as to the transfer to them. Only as to the initial transfer from the debtor to the initial transferee. And the transfer from the debtor to the initial transferee here were not pursuant to any form of securities transaction whatsoever. They were pursuant to notes, promissory notes. They were the repayment of promissory notes, which also happened to be covered by the credit agreement that you referenced, Your Honor. Accordingly, the district court was confused, and Safe Harbor furthered that confusion by trying to mesh together the various transfers and transactions. They are not all of the same. We have two phases of transfers. The trustee seeks to recover or claw back the initial transfer, and after the clawback, after the avoidance of that transfer, then recover the money from the subsequent transferee. There is no 546E protection for the subsequent transfer to the subsequent transferee. So Safe Harbor doesn't get that benefit vis-a-vis the transfer. It only gets that benefit vis-a-vis the transfer from the debtor to the initial transferee. We brought motion for default and obtained judgment as to those initial transfers, which totaled over $900 million. The business done between Fry, who's a convicted felon relative to this matter, and MGC Finance, that transaction resulted in payments to Fry's entities of over $900 million. Subsequent to those $900 million being transferred to Fry's entities, Fry's entities parsed that money out to investors who invested through the note purchase agreement.
Why isn't it in connection with a securities contract if the statute defines security to include a note?
The statute does not, there's law very specifically, Your Honor, that says that the notes themselves, if it's called a note and it actually is a promissory note, it is not a securities transaction.
Well, I don't know what you mean. I'm looking at the definition in Section 101, Sub 49, the term security includes note.
Right, if it's used in a securities transaction. This is not a securities transaction. Just a promissory note alone, sitting by itself, is not a securities transaction. It can include, you can have a security that includes notes. If it's being packaged and sold as a security, like is being suggested, and we're not necessarily denying that the note purchase agreement, which was the subsequent transferee, was in fact a security. We're not concluding that here, but that one is more akin to a security because it was packaged up and sold to investors. Whereas we have a straight lending arrangement between Metro One and ACP on the one hand and MGC the debtor. It's a straight lending arrangement. And in a straight lending arrangement, it's not a securities. I think the Rivas case also says that. That notes themselves, in and of themselves, are not securities.
Well, how does it deal with the statute that says the term security includes note?
There is no law that says that a straight note, Your Honor, is in fact a security. And there's no law interpreting that statute that way.
I'm just right, quoting the statute. You say there's no law. That is the law.
Understand. Again, I think the interpretation of that statute is such that a note can be a security. If you, for instance, package those notes up and look at subprime lending. Subprime lending packaged up notes and then sold those. That's a security. So it can be part of a securities transaction, but in and of itself, as a borrowing arrangement, it is not a security.
What's your position on whether Wells Fargo is a custodian for purposes of this 546E?
Our position is the district court never did the analysis, Your Honor.
What's your position on whether Wells Fargo is a custodian for purposes of 546E?
I believe that Wells Fargo, based on merit management, would not be a custodian sufficient to satisfy the requirements of 546E. And merit management is the controlling law and the only U.S. Supreme Court opinion relevant here.
I didn't think it really addressed what is a custodian.
I think when you put it in the context of your question, Your Honor, if I may, maybe I misunderstood, but if you put it in the context of your question and you said as relative to 546E. So we see that there's multiple definitions of the word custodian. There's Merriam's dictionary definition. There's 101's definition. If we want to talk about how does custodian fit vis-a-vis 546E's application, I would say that Wells Fargo is not. It was not intended to be in this context. And
well,
would not
maybe
apply.
It wasn't a great question because the term custodian is not in 546E, but I was thinking of the fact that financial institution is is in 546E, and I thought everyone agreed that the statutory definition of financial institution applies here from Section 101, Sub 22, which refers to, as you know, a bank acting as custodian.
I do believe that needs further analysis in this case, Your Honor. I think that that is something that this
court... I'm asking you for your analysis. I'm asking you... I don't know what you mean it needs further analysis. It's a legal question, and that's what we decide a lot of the time. So I'd rather not just settle for send it back if you could address the question.
We believe in the context of 546E, it would not qualify. However, the document relative to the account itself does indicate that it is acting as a custodian. There is a document, which is the account agreement, I believe. I'm sorry, I'm misstating the actual title of that document. But it was a document that even Safe Harbor presented to the trustee and asked the trustee, does it not say right here that Wells Fargo is acting as custodian? Well, the district court didn't look at those responses. It didn't consider those responses as part of its ruling. And just because the trustee said that, yes, it does indicate that its title is custodian, does not mean that that then would satisfy the requirements of 546E. I do not believe it would satisfy the requirements of 546E, if you're asking my opinion. I see that I'm nearly out of time. I was going to reserve some rebuttal. May I wrap up briefly, Your Honor?
Do you think that, let me ask you one more question. Do you think that the statutory definition of custodian in Section 101 sub 11 applies in determining whether Wells Fargo is a custodian within the definition of financial institution?
I believe we have some obvious holes in our statute, Your Honor. And I believe that is the reason that we're having these discussions. I believe that the 546E has become contentious for that reason.
Never mind. I just wanted to know if you think the statutory definition of custodian applies. You seem to say so in your brief, but I guess you don't want to address that now.
I do, Your Honor.
You do think
that I think the statutory definition is as stated, indicates that Wells Fargo could potentially be acting as custodian relative to the subsequent transfer, not the initial transfer. So I have to qualify the answer that you're to the question you're asking.
Whether you thought it qualified. I was asking whether you think we should look to the statutory definition of custodian as opposed to some other definition of custodian, like a ordinary meaning of the term or a dictionary definition. That's all I'm asking you.
Then the answer would be yes.
Okay. Well, I've taken up the rest of your time. We'll try to give you a couple minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you.
Mr. Markham, we'll hear from you.
Thank you. May it please the court, Michael Markham. I represent Safe Harbor, the defendant in the underlying adversary proceeding. There was certainly one thing that Mr. Levin said that I agree with, and that this is a relatively simple matter. I think it's been complicated by the trustees' unwillingness to answer fairly straightforward questions to the district court and now even to this court. My client was sued under Section 550 of the Bankruptcy Code as a subsequent transferee. Section 550 states that to the extent an initial transfer is avoided, the trustee may recover from the subsequent transferee. So, if the initial transferee, in this case the transfers to ACP2, are protected by 546E, then there is no claim against Safe Harbor as a subsequent transferee. I take great exception to any argument that the district judge was confused about which transfers we were talking about. I think it was clear in both sides' briefing and the judge's decision that certainly my client was focused on and the district judge was focused on the transfers from the debtor to ACP2. Certainly there were other
issues. Didn't he have one of the names wrong though in the order?
He did, Your Honor, and let me speak to that because he did use the word, the term, the party Metro.
That's when he should have said MGC Finance, right?
That's right, Your Honor. He confused Metro as a debtor entity. But let me just say this, Judge. I think that issue was exacerbated by some of what was in the papers and some was at the argument. For example, the trustee had already admitted in request for admissions that the transfers were made in connection with the note purchase agreement. And the trustee made that admission, even though the trustee knew that the debtor was not a party to that note purchase agreement. So the transfers, and the transfers that the trustee admitted, were the transfers from the debtor to ACP2. So it really doesn't matter that the judge misidentified a party because the trustee had already admitted that the subject transfers were made in connection with the note purchase agreement. Another thing that confused the issue, I think, is that at oral argument before the district court, trustee's counsel admitted that ACP2 purchased notes from MGC Finance. Well, when you say ACP2 purchased notes from MGC Finance, it makes it sound like that the note purchase agreement included the debtor entity. It just so happened this note purchase agreement was between ACP2 and Metro, but the note purchase agreement was part and parcel of the overall transaction that was a variety of agreements that were entered into all at the same time, which I'll get to. So the real question here is whether ACP2, as a customer of Wells Fargo, and a customer of Wells Fargo under a written custodial agreement, is a financial institution by definition, and that definition being provided in Section 101, Sub 22, that makes it clear that a customer of a financial institution can qualify as a definitional financial institution where that bank is acting as a custodian for that customer. That's precisely what happened in this case.
Do you think we use the statutory definition of custodian to complete the analysis of financial institution?
I suspect that that would be the best way to do it, Your Honor, but with all due respect to the other side, they never raised this issue with the district court judge. The first time the trustee ever made any mention of the definition of custodian in 101 sub 11 was in their brief to this court. They never once raised this. So to accuse the district court judge of not applying the statute when they never brought the statute to his attention is just not fair. But in any event, there are more than one definition of custodian or more than one type of custodian under the definition in 101 sub 11. One is a custodian that administers the general property of the debtor, but another one is a custodian that's acting under a contract for the purpose of enforcing a lien. There is no question here that ACP2 was granted a lien on the notes that were put into the custodial account. These notes themselves were actually deposited into the custodial accounts at Wells Fargo. If you look at the statements that are part of our appendix, you will see statements that actually have the notes themselves deposited into those accounts. These weren't just simple loans.
Whose accounts were they?
The custodial accounts of ACP2 at Wells Fargo.
Okay.
So when the notes...
But the part of the definition that you quoted, you left out some words. The statute says under a contract that is appointed or authorized to take charge of property of the debtor for the purpose of enforcing a lien.
Correct, Your Honor. And the very transfers that we're talking about here, the transfers from the debtor to ACP2, that cash, those proceeds of those notes, that was debtor property on which ACP2 was granted a lien under the custodial account agreement. The custodial account agreement is a separate document of the same date, July 18th of 2001, to which the debtor is a party. The custodial account agreement, the parties are Wells Fargo, the custodian, Petters 1, the debtor, and then the ACP2 entities. So what you have there in that document, the collateral account agreement, specifically identifies Wells Fargo as a custodian and specifically states that that the secured parties, i.e. ACP2, are being granted a security interest on those notes and the proceeds of those notes that are being deposited into the accounts at Wells Fargo. So it's frankly...
How are the funds in the Wells Fargo accounts property of the debtor?
Well, when they come, they are until they get there. And when they get there, then they're in those accounts and they're collateral of
the property of ACP too at that point.
I guess, Your Honor, you know, we could have a whole nother law review article about what constitutes property of the estate when money is
moved. I don't want a law review article. I just want, for purposes of this case, to understand whether Wells Fargo's a custodian. Go ahead. If you think it takes a law review article, I'll hear you out.
No. I just meant from the standpoint of what's property of the estate, Judge. Just because money would move into an account that's not titled in the debtor's name wouldn't necessarily mean that that money could not be property of the estate under some argument. That was my point.
Is there an argument that the money in ACP2's accounts is property of the debtor?
I guess there could have been, Your Honor. That's really not an issue in this case. I was just trying to respond to your question about whether that was property of the estate. But clearly,
I thought it was an issue in this case because it's in the definition of custodian. Well, that Wells Fargo is only a custodian, as I understand it, if it's authorized to take charge of property of the debtor for the purpose of enforcing a lien. So I was concerned whether they've taken charge of property of the debtor or if they're just managing money for ACP2, which is not a debtor.
Well, Your Honor, you have to look at that also in through the lens of the admissions that were made in the case. A specific admission by the trustee was Wells Fargo acted as agent or custodian for ACP2, its customer, in connection with the transfers to ACP2. That's a direct admission, a request for admission where the answer was simply admitted. So they admitted that Wells Fargo acted as agent or custodian for ACP2, its customer, in connection with the transfers to ACP2. Frankly, Judge, I don't think we go any further than that, and that's why I think the judge didn't go any further than that, and that's why I think the trustee didn't go any further than that. The trustee, as best I can tell, this was an afterthought argument that they thought up after they filed the notice of appeal, because it was the very first time that anybody had ever made any reference to the definition of custodian in the statute. But I would submit, Your Honor, that there were liens granted, and that was the purpose, that Wells Fargo was there as a custodian to hold collateral for the benefit of its customer, ACP2. So you have that admission, Your Honor. You have a written custodial agreement between Wells Fargo and its customer, ACP2. You have in the trustee's complaint an allegation that Wells Fargo was maintaining a custodial account. And then you have the custodial account agreement that I mentioned that the debtor was in fact a party to, that confirms that Wells Fargo was acting as a custodian under the custodial agreement. So I think for all of those reasons, and primarily the admission, which I don't know how the trustee gets beyond that admission, they simply can't argue that they didn't understand what the admission was. It was clear. I mean, it was a clear request and a clear answer that it was admitted. So once you make the leap or make the conclusion on the first...
Just one question on the admission. Was it a request for an admission that Wells Fargo was a custodian for purposes of the definition of financial institution?
No, Your Honor. I'll read it to you word for word. Wells Fargo acted as agent or custodian for ACP2, its customer, in connection with the transfers to ACP2. So I didn't want to ask somebody to admit to a statutory definition. I would have thought that would have drawn an objection that I was asking somebody for a legal conclusion. I thought what I asked was a factual statement, and they admitted that factual statement.
I guess then the question is, does that factual admission get you to the legal conclusion that they're a custodian within the meaning of the statutory definition of financial institution?
I certainly understand your point, Your Honor, but I think even still, on the facts before the court that were uncontroverted, the different agreements, even under the secondary definition in 101 sub 11, Wells Fargo was clearly acting under a contract a written custodial agreement, and a collateral account agreement for the purpose of enforcing the lien. And I think the main document there, Judge, if you'll look to, is the collateral account agreement that is very clear that the company in this document, Judge, is Petters 1. It says the company, Petters 1, the debtor, hereby grants to Metro on behalf of the secured parties, i.e. ACP2, a present and continuing security interest in the collateral account and all proceeds thereof. So what was being placed into the collateral account? The notes themselves and proceeds that could have come from those. So I don't think there's any question either way that Wells Fargo's purpose under those agreements was to be there to enforce a lien. So that just gets us to the next question, Judge, which is whether the transfers were made in connection with the securities contract. Again, there were two express admissions here. The trustee expressly admitted that the transfers were made in connection with the note purchase agreement, and the trustee expressly admitted that the transfers were made in connection with the collateral account agreement. The trustee wants to make an argument to say that the payments were made pursuant to the notes. Okay, fine. I don't care if they were made pursuant to the notes. The question isn't whether the payments were made pursuant to the notes. The question is whether the payments were made in connection with, a much broader term, one of the many securities contracts that are here. A note purchase agreement, the collateral account agreement, the custodial agreement. The definition of securities contract in 741 sub 7 is very broad. And I want to get to a point your Honor asked. And you were really asking Judge Colleton about the definition of security. And throughout this case, the trustee, for whatever reason, has refused to acknowledge that a note is a security. And so, but really, then you've got to look at, is it a securities contract? No, a note is not a securities contract. And my clients never argued that a note was a securities contract. A securities contract is, for example, a contract for purchase or sale of a note. We clearly have that here. The trustee admitted at oral argument that ACP2 purchased notes from MGC Finance, a debtor entity. So I don't, whether the debtor was a party to the note purchase agreement doesn't make a difference. A note purchase agreement is without question a securities contract, and the trustee has expressly admitted that a note purchase agreement, or that the transfers were made in connection with the note purchase agreement. And so I really think what happened is that because of these admissions, it was easy for the district court judge to reach some of these conclusions. But this case has nothing to do with merit management. Merit management was an intermediary or mere custodian case. This is about whether the customer can be a financial institution, and the record, everything in the record here suggests that that's the case. And if you look at the summary judgment record, there is no contravening evidence from the trustee on this issue. All you have is a bare legal argument raised for the first time on appeal. I think the district judge should be affirmed.
So I did have one last question. Why do you think the judge ended up going on custodian rather than agent? I noticed that when you were quoting your admissions, you said agent or custodian. Was it briefed all in terms of custodian, or did the judge just choose one versus the other? Do you know, can you explain that?
My guess is that he chose custodian because we had a written custodial agreement. The admission is clear. And the admission, that's why the admission really governs the day, because the trustees admitted that they're the agent or custodian. So even if they're not a definitional custodian, there is no definition of agent. Agent is more of a common law term. And that was the real issue raised in Tribune. And that's where the big issue is. Obviously, whether a party is, there's a fine line between whether a financial institution could be an agent or an intermediary, right? Merit tells us an intermediary bank is not good enough, but But Tribune tells us that an agent financial institution is good enough. In this case, you have not only an admission that Wells Fargo was acting as a custodian, but also as an agent. So at the end of the day, you don't need to get to this more sticky, I guess, custodian issue because they've also admitted that Wells Fargo was acting as ACP2's agent. So either one, I think my client would have prevailed on.
Well, maybe, you know, agent hasn't really been presented to our court. And of course, there's some debate about whether Tribune is correctly decided. I just wondered how it is that it came to us as custodian rather than agent, but I appreciate your answer. All right. Well, thank you for your argument. Mr. Levin, we'll give you 2 minutes for rebuttal. Please turn on your microphone.
How about now, Your Honor?
Yes, we can hear you.
Very good. Thank you. Your Honor, there's some gross misrepresentations of fact by Mr. Markham. MGC was not a party to any type of note purchase. There were no notes sold or no notes bought by MGC, the debtor. That was between Metro ACP and its investors. The Metro did a deal with ACP to sell the notes to ACP, and that was pursuant to the note purchase agreement. The debtor was not a party to that. So the debtor was not a party to anything that would qualify as a securities transaction. And just because a note can be a security, it doesn't become a securities transaction, as we talked about earlier, until they're packaged up and sold in bulk, for instance. But just the note by itself is not a security. And the fact that there were multiple notes between MGC Finance and Metro One does not all of a sudden make it a security. And the admissions of the trustee have no bearing here whatsoever. In fact, Mr. Markham himself said that we should dismiss Merit Management because it's a mere custodial case. Fine. Well, if you want the trustee's admission that it was a custodian arrangement, let's talk about whether or not it was a mere custodial arrangement. But that doesn't matter. The trustee's admission that it was a custodial arrangement could very well have been based just on the fact that that's what it said on the surface of the document. And we still have to pare it down and see whether or not they were truly acting as a custodian. Just as the document says it so, and just as the trustee affirmed that the document says it so, doesn't mean that that qualifies as part of the exception under 546E. We're talking about a lot of different moving parts here, and Mr. Markham wants to mush them all together again. There are two sets of transfers. The initial transfer was clearly not a securities transaction. They were notes. It was one note here, one note there, another note there, another note there, and another note there. And we add all those up, and it was $900-some-odd million in repayments of notes that went from the debtor to Metro and ACP. Then what Metro and AC did with it after that may have been securities transactions. In fact, arguably it is. But that's not the point. The point is they only get the protection with respect to the transfer from the debtor. 546E only applies on the initial transfer from the debtor to Metro One or ACP. That was simply the repayment of notes.
All right. Thank you for your rebuttal. Thank you to both counsel for your arguments. The case is submitted. The court will file a decision in due course.